GBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News,
app.
I'm Andy Field. The CDC investigating new monkeypox cases in mostly vaccinated people. The agency working alongside state health departments. New vaccination pushes underway in New York and San Francisco. Chicago health officials recently warned of new infections. Last week's dozen new monkeypox cases in Chicago was the highest since November. Relatives outside the courthouse in Boise, Idaho, after a jury convicted Lori Vallow Daybell of killing her two children and a romantic rival in what prosecutors say was a doomsday plot. In El Paso, Texas, city leaders say they've noticed an overnight jump in people seeking asylum, but those numbers remain, quote, truly low. A day after COVID restrictions on asylum seekers expired, Mayor Oscar Leeser saying they can handle it.
We know that this is just the beginning of the change of immigration law, so it'll be new to us and we'll be prepared for it.
Wall Street had a slightly down day. This is ABC News. There's a puzzle to be solved at the top of a high-rise owned by Adobe in San Jose.
Outside Adobe headquarters in downtown San Jose, there's a crowd staring at the building. It's called a semaphore, four revolving circles lit up by LED lights on the building, transmitting a secret message. Adobe wants somebody to crack the code.
It's uniquely strange.
Going back to 2006, Adobe has transmitted two other codes. Now a third is waiting to be solved. Valerie Tu is a grad student getting her master's in math.
Pattern recognition is definitely key.
If you want to try to solve it, Adobe is streaming a live feed of the secret message online. Alex Stone, ABC News.
It took the last person 4.5 years to solve the previous code. And snakes on a plane. Customs agents at an airport in India seizing 22 snakes and a chameleon from a woman's luggage. They found the reptiles transported from Malaysia, packed into transparent plastic containers. Andy Field, ABC News.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. Two people were treated for head injuries after a small plane crashed Thursday morning in Wisconsin Rapids. The plane landed near the intersection of Whitrock Avenue and 15th Place. First responders found the plane overturned. They were able to get the man and woman out, who were then transported to local hospitals. Witnesses told police the plane landed on Whitrock Avenue. As it continued down the street, it struck a road sign, which caused the plane to spin and roll over onto its roof. The crash is being investigated by the FAA. On Sunday, flags in Wisconsin will fly at half-staff in honor of Hmong Lao Veterans Day. Governor Evers signed Wisconsin Act 31 in 2021, honoring the thousands of Hmong Lao veterans who fought alongside the U.S. during the Vietnam War. Wisconsin is now home to the third largest Hmong population in the U.S. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
Are you working way too hard for way too little? There's never been a better time to consider a career in IT. You could enjoy a recession-resistant career in a rewarding field with plenty of growth opportunities and often flexible work environments. Go to mycomputercareer.edu and take the free career evaluation. You could start your new career in months, not years. Take classes online or on campus, and financial aid is available to qualified students, including the GI Bill. Now is the time. mycomputercareer.edu.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now. And AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown.
Monday mornings at 8 on WISS and WGBW, and on the Civic Media app.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Ready for our little forest adventure?
Yes!
So much waiting for me. Yeah, I wanna go outside. I wanna be.
We're here.
Whoa, that was fast.
There's a forest closer than you think. Find a park or forest near you and music inspired by nature at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by USDA Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Job numbers out. Another good job numbers. No matter what the Fed is trying to do, no matter what Republicans are working on doing, job numbers still really good. 253,000 new jobs created in the month of April, beating expectations. Once again, 11,000 of those manufacturing jobs, bringing back those. You know, it's one of these things where you go, I know the doomsdayers and the anti Biden folks, they're all, it's bad. You know, this is another month of beating expectations. 12.7 million jobs created during Biden's term thus far. Unemployment down to 3.4%, lowest since the late 60s. Black unemployment, historic low at 4.7. Hispanic unemployment, historic low, 4.4%. Now imagine, and I was thinking about this today, imagine had this been what Trump was able to accomplish. Can you imagine the right-wing spin machine and just effusive with praise on how Donald Trump did this all by himself, did it all alone. Donald did it all. You've got more people now participating in the labor force than we had before 2008. Inflation's coming down. Wages are higher. All this stuff is going on, and yet you talk to the average person because of what's being projected by our corporate-controlled mainstream media and what you've got. Well, what you've got is, you know, people who are going, oh, the economy's bad, things are bad, we're in the wrong direction. I say we're going in the right direction. We're investing in infrastructure, we're reshoring manufacturing, something that I've been screaming for a couple of decades now. We're finally doing some of this. Understand, you can't just flip on the switch and everything goes well. Biden, like Obama, like Clinton before, like Carter even, inherited a mess, inherited an economy in crisis. And again, these are, we go through this. We go through a couple of years of a Republican presidency where they destroy everything. And, you know, jobs are going down and the economy's, people are losing their homes and losing their jobs. And things are not good. And then Democrats come in and start moving in a better direction. And all the while, Republicans go, see how bad things are? They did this. Because they think we're stupid and we're not going to remember that, wait a second. You know, this happened because of horrible conservative supply side voodoo Reaganomic and bad fetish policy. I saw an interesting graph today that said under Democratic presidents, the average job growth per month was over 175,000 jobs per month, every month that a Democrat was in the Oval Office, going back to 1939. 175,000 new jobs every month. And you go, well, the Republicans must have done much better than that. No. In fact, you know, 67, it's almost three times the number. 67,000 is what Republicans created during the, and I got to understand, you know, we're talking the FDR years, we're talking Truman, we're talking Kennedy, LBJ, Carter, Clinton, Obama, and now Biden, versus the record of Eisenhower, Nixon, Reagan, Bush, and Trump. And the numbers don't lie. It's like the old Harry Truman, quote. If you want to live like a Republican, vote for a Democrat, because your life is going to get better. And that's true. The economic policies of investing in stuff and getting people to work and giving people the ability to earn a decent wage and get ahead, those are Democratic principles. Squeezing the quarter till the eagle screams before you take it out of a working person's pocket is not a good policy. And it's what Republicans have done. And for me, you know, it comes back to, you know, how do we make it possible for families to move forward? How do we make it possible for workers to do better? And I had an interesting conversation today. It was one of these things where I've had this conversation got to be 1,000 times now. And it goes like this. And understand, no generation is unique. Every generation throughout the history of humanity, I am certain, has done this, has looked behind them and goes, you know, those kids, they got it easy. When I was a kid, things were much harder. And it's true. It's back, you know, back when the wheels were square on the buggy, it was probably harder to push that buggy. When they figured out how to make round wheels, got a lot easier. When they figured out a horse could pull it, got even easier than that. When they figured out a steam engine could pull it, so much easier. So every generation looks back and goes, you know, things I had to work harder than you. And this was one of those. And I know none of us like to have this, but this was one of those conversation of how young people are lazy. No one wants to work. And I'm like, you know, again, do we have to do this? And the answer was yes. We most certainly had to do this. And, you know, as you get this knee-jerk commentary that a segment of our population seems fixated on, my mind went to this place of going, yeah, I'm tired of this already. This propping ourselves up because we think we're superior to anyone else. But then I started thinking about it. I mean, you know, we're fixated on, you know, on the hot takes as opposed to a thoughtful conversation. And right now this guy's hot take was, they're lazy. I'm the hero in my movie, so to speak. I'm the hero in my show. I pulled myself up by the bootstraps. I paid my dues. And it got me thinking. It got me thinking, too, you know, if I were a young person today, you know, would I have done the same things that I've done throughout my working life? You can ask my wife, the 26 year, odd years we've been together, I've never not worked less than 70 hours. I've always been a chronic workaholic. It's one of those things, you know, growing up poor, it's one of those things where you go, my kids are not going to suffer the way I did. And I think every generation thinks that way as well. But here's the thing. And this is where my mind is in this weird spot. I grew up believing that if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you'd get ahead. You know, this idea that, you know, if you paid your dues. And look, I think Generation X, which I am a part of, and I think we believe this, you know, the boomers, I think, believed it as well, that if you work hard, you played by the rules, you put your time in, paid your dues, you'd make it, you'd get ahead, you'd do better, you'd have opportunity down the road, and it was going to be okay. I don't know that the coming generation, I don't know that they believe that the way we do. They don't believe there is a future for them that is as prosperous as it was for the past. They don't believe, in talking with them, they don't believe that the institutions that we relied on are going to survive to help them thrive. And who can blame them? Their entire lives, they were told, you're going to see a UFO before you see a Social Security check. And then you see Republicans doing everything they can do to make that a reality. So am I surprised that when they go, well, you don't have to work for somebody because there's no real reason for that. I go, I kind of get it. Coming out of the pandemic, when we were told you're essential and you're frontline heroes, and we slapped them on the back, or, virtually, of course, and, gave them all of this praise and titles and put them up on a pedestal, only to say, sorry, but that's not going to come with any raise or any additional income. It's just, we want you to know that we're happy that you're risking your life for the rest of us. And it got me to thinking that the middle class, which was, we're trained as a population, we're all going to be in the middle class, all of us. What it takes to get into the middle class simply is to be in the middle of the income. And that middle income was sufficient to do a number of things. To buy a home, to save for the future, to have a lot of the nice things that you expect, vacations and cars and all of this stuff. Security, a little financial security. That's what part of the middle class is. And as you go back and you look at the numbers, and I'm a numbers kind of guy. For instance, in 2010, in order to be in that middle class, the median income, the average income that they threw out, was about 74 grand a year in 2010 to be considered middle class. Today, it's about 90,000. It's gone up. And how many people make $90,000 a year? And if you take in inflation into account, that 74 grand from 2010 is actually like 101,000 today. So there's an $11,000 pay gap there between the standard of living you had in 2010 as opposed to what you have today. And the fact of the matter is, and we see it through bad tax policy, we see it in how much people have had to pay for health care and all kinds of things, that the percentage of wealth that's going to that American middle class has diminished. And it's one of those things where you go, by how much? Well, consider in 1970, that middle class, that 50% of the population that's in the middle, it's not the 25% at the bottom or the 25% at the top, it's that middle, it's those middle two quintile groups, the middle class. Those two, that middle part, took 62% of the income. They were doing okay. They were making a little bit of money. As of 2014, that number had fallen to 43%, and I would argue it's under 40% now. So we're losing a ton of income. And you go, well, where did it go? Well, we know where it's gone. It's gone to the very top, to the 1%, and really the 1% of the 1%. We came out of the pandemic. How much money went to our billionaire class? A couple of trillion dollars? How many people at the bottom of the economy got worse off? I mean, this is the part that gets me, and I go back to, I understand why people don't want to work hard like my generation had to. Because the reward's not there. You look at what people, you look down on. I get this all the time. You go to dinner parties. So what do you do for a living? I'm a truck driver. Oh. Yeah, I make a good living as a truck driver. I'm very happy with that. I've been a union truck driver my whole life. I've done very well. I've got a pension. I've got all kinds of, I'm going to be okay. Thanks very much. Thanks for looking down on us. But you go through mechanics, electricians, pipe fitters, plumbers, all jobs that people look down the tip of their nose at. But you've got people who are going, well, what do you ask a kid today what they want to be? They want to be a social media influencer, athlete, actor, whatever. They want to be at the top of it because there's where the reward is. It's where the money is. It's where the appreciation is. And what we have is a system that's set up that if you work a job, like literally work for a living, you're somehow looked down on. Now, I hope that's changing. But it still doesn't mean that we're going to distribute wealth the way we used to. And for a working class family to exist in this day and age, you have to have two incomes, a minimum of two incomes. And I've argued here recently that it's going to be more than two incomes. You're going to need three at some point. So that means you're going to need to send the kids into the workforce. Get the kids out there working, bring a third income into the house. Then you can be middle class again. And, you know, it just popped into my head. I remember this woman. We were having a conversation about what middle class was. And this is going back probably 15 years. And this will never leave me. She said that she believed that she was, you know, middle class. And I said, well, how much do you make a year? Because we usually, middle class is usually an income kind of thing. And she said at the time, like 15 grand a year, which puts you nowhere near the middle class, even 15 years ago. And I explained that to her. I go, you do realize that that's not enough to be into the middle class. She goes, no, I'm in the middle class because I don't take anything from government. That was her definition, that she didn't need food stamps. She didn't need LIHEAP or any of the programs to help her, that she was able to make it on her own, which made her middle class. And I kind of broke her heart. I go, do you get money back at the end of the year from paying your taxes? She goes, yeah, I get a pretty good chunk back. I go, how much do you get? And she's like $3,000 or $4,000. And I said, well, that is getting something from the government because you didn't pay that much in, but you got more out. That's help. That's a good thing. I'm all in favor of it. But it kind of blows your idea out of the water. And she was very angry at me. But, you know, down the road came back and said, you know, you're probably right. So we have this idea that we're all part of the middle class, that we're part of this. And I want everyone to at least be there. I want people to be better. But the fact of the matter is it's much harder. It's much harder to make ends meet today. Now, what I found interesting is as I was talking to my friend who was ranting and raving about how lazy Gen Z is, I said, I don't know that I would do the kind of things that I did because I don't know the reward is there. The wages certainly aren't. The benefits aren't. And quite frankly, the loyalty isn't. You know, I still held on to the idea that you could work, you know, 40 years for a company, get a gold watch and a pension, and you would be okay. This generation understands that's not going to happen. They know that their future is tenuous at best, and whatever skills they have today, they're going to have to change, you know, repeatedly over the decades. And there's part of me that goes, you know, I get it. Now, my friend, with the frame of they're all lazy, didn't know how to answer when I said, hey, you know, you do realize Gen Z, if I need to defend them from you, they actually have a home ownership rate much higher than Gen X did and higher than the millennials did. And, you know, he didn't believe me and I had to send him the documentation later. But yeah, surprisingly, and, you know, close to what the baby boomers were able to accomplish at this point in their lives. So there are people in Gen Z, regardless of what the mainstream message is, that they're all lazy, that are actually, you know, moving on with their lives. And doing okay. And that's a good thing. I'm hoping the narrative spins around. But again, I come back to this. It's the jobs. When do we demand better wages, hours, conditions? You know, what's interesting? Somebody threw another statistic at me that said in the 1980s, the average house, average home was, you know, 4 to 5 times the median income. Today, that number's 7.5, almost 8 times. And you think about what it takes to buy a house, the fact that Gen Z is far above the Gen X and the millennials, kind of throws that whole, they're not responsible, they're lazy, kind of throws that right out the window. So I hope he takes it to heart. But I want to hear your thoughts. Is Gen Z lazy? Are they all lazy? They just want to lay around and play video games all day? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Georgia Governor Brian Kemp has signed a piece of legislation that would create this new commission. And it would empower this commission to discipline and remove any of those bad prosecutors. Or he even said it. Far left prosecutors, the ones that are making our communities less safe. We're going to be able to go after those far left prosecutors. He said, I'm not going to stand idly by as rogue or incompetent prosecutors refuse to uphold the law. Today, we are sending a message that we will not forfeit public safety for prosecutors to let criminals off the hook. And I got this thought today. That, you know what, thank goodness they're going to prosecute criminals in Georgia, because today, at least 8 of the 16 Georgia Republican electors, they weren't really electors. They were the fake electors. They were the alternative electors. To where if Mike Pence would have done what they wanted him to do, then these fake electors would have been the ones. But ultimately didn't happen. So you've got these 16 Republicans who put their name on the line. At least 8 of them have accepted immunity, which means maybe they're going to go after criminals in Georgia. You know, maybe ones that make phone calls, you know, saying, hey, go find me votes. Or else, you know. Now what's interesting is, you know, I know where this is going. This is going after Fannie Willis and the Fulton County District Attorney, who is pursuing, this whole thing. The perfect phone call, the fake electors. This is kind of a big deal. What happens now that this is law? And Brian Kemp goes, you know what? Fannie Willis has got to go. We're going to throw her out. Could this be what helps Trump, you know, stay out of trouble, at least in Georgia? I'm thinking it could be. And it could also, because I've been saying that Brian Kemp from the beginning, Brian Kemp was a guy that I say maybe worry about, because, you know, he's a good old boy and he knows how to get things done. Now, I don't think he's going to get far once you find the family history, because he's only one generation off the plantation, running the plantation, that is. But the thing is, you know, MAGA world could love this. He's going to free up Trump to not get prosecuted. So he's got the MAGA bona fides. And look, he's a smooth talker. And he could be the guy who says, hey, we're going to move forward. I'm as Trumpy as anyone. Trust me, I'm as MAGA as anyone. But I want to move forward. I want to do all this other stuff and maybe have an agenda, as where Trump just seems to want to take us backwards. In fact, you know, evidently he's saying that, you know, he wants to bring the Muslim bans back. Go, you know, whenever things are bad, you know, it's bad when they start breaking out the oldies. And the oldie here being, hey, we're going to go get those people. More divide and conquer. Now, the good thing is the Democrats are going to help. Because evidently Joe Manchin hasn't ruled out a third-party run for president, because I think he knows he's going to get beaten in West Virginia by Jim Justice. But the no-labels folks, they're pushing. And you know who's behind it? Trader Joe Lieberman. I got to tell you, I didn't even know he was still around. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1886. That was the day Wisconsin State Militia shot down workers striking for the 8-hour day in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, killing 7. It's known as the Bayview Massacre. As cities across America erupted into strikes for the 8-hour day, municipal workers in Milwaukee had already won shorter working hours. Many private employers had followed suit. The Central Labor Union and the Knights of Labor mobilized thousands in the campaign to bring the rest of the city's employers into line. Building tradesmen joined Polish, German, and Native American laborers in strikes and marches across the city for nearly a week. They marched to area factories, calling out to workers to join the strike. By May 3rd, every factory in town was shut down except for the Milwaukee Iron Company rolling mill in Bayview. Workers marched to the mills and demanded workers join them. At this point, Governor Rusk called out the militia. They formed a line just inside the gate to prevent strikers from reaching mill workers. As the events of Haymarket unfolded in Chicago that evening, area businessmen became increasingly fearful of upheaval brewing in the city. Governor Rusk gave the shoot to kill order should any striker attempt to enter the mills. The next morning, as 1,500 strikers marched toward the mill, they were fired upon by militia. 7 were killed, many more injured. Strikes for the 8-hour day ended abruptly. Many union leaders were indicted, and Polish workers were practically blacklisted from working in the city for their radicalism. Though the massacres shattered hopes for the 8-hour day, Milwaukeeans responded by electing populists and socialists in local and regional elections for years to come. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
When public officials get themselves mired in the muck of corruption, they can always count on Senator Ted Cruz to issue a moral judgment. If the offender is a Democrat, he pronounces the corruption inexcusably grotesque. If it's a Republican, he wails that the offender is the victim. For example, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was recently caught, yet again, butt deep in judicial immorality, taking hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of freebies from a Texas real estate baron who has both a partisan and corporate interest in Thomas's court rulings. So, Cruz to the rescue! No judicial impropriety here, he squawks, for this is nothing but a diabolical plot by Democrats to smear poor Clarence. But Thomas is busy smearing himself, so Dems can just take the advice of Woodrow Wilson. Never attempt to murder a man who's committing suicide. From the start of his court tenure, Thomas has been a shameless seeker of personal gain, tucking untold sums from untold sources in the inner pockets of his judicial robes. He learned to hide his corruption in 2004 when he actually reported taking pricey gifts from a special interest, which got him widely condemned. So, he reformed. No, he didn't quit taking gimmies, he just quit disclosing them. Thomas is a supreme grifter, but sadly he's not alone. Many recent justices have fallen from the pedestal of judicial integrity, cozying up to the moneyed interests. Gifts aside, we now have a hyper-partisan right-wing Republican majority taking their judicial opinions from those same interests, turning America's unelected third branch of government into an autocratic, plutocratic political agency. Then they wonder why their public approval rating and legitimacy are in the ditch. This is Jim Hightower saying, since they won't reform themselves, we must do it for them. To help, go to fixthecourt.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we're seeing all across the country, Republicans doing their foolhardy best, pushing more restrictions and obstacles on voting. ceding more power to the hands of their ideological wet dreams while simultaneously pushing the deregulation fetish. You got to give them credit. When they get power, they know how to abuse it. Some lessons to be learned there. And here to share some thoughts on a couple of the most recent bits out of Texas on the voting rights front and also a bunch of preemption stuff. I've asked Jeremy Wallace to come talk with us. Jeremy is the political writer for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News. Jeremy, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, I'm so glad to be on the show. Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So let's start with this voting bill. Most of them have been in the way of, you know, we've seen the caging of the past. We've seen, you know, people being thrown off the voting rolls because they're supposedly going to be felons at some point. We've seen the blocking of you know, throwing people off of lists. We've seen, you know, all kinds of gimmicks. This one's a little bit more interesting what they're doing in Texas. As I understand it, they're going to go into a particular county, I guess, and decide, you know, maybe we're not going to have this result. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, this is not your garden variety elections bill. Right? So there's a bunch of them. You know, like the legislature here only meets every 2 years, once every 2 years. So they'll do a lot of stuff quickly, right? You know, but this time around, they ended up with this monster bill. Like everybody's tracking all these different bills, but this one was kind of like tucked into everything. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting there in the Texas Senate one day, and here they are, all of a sudden, muscling this bill to the front, which is going to give the governor or the governor's appointee the power to overturn an election in Harris County, Texas, if they ever run out of paper at any of their polling sites ever again. They had some problems in this last election cycle, but their solution for the Republicans, at least, their solution is, oh, okay, we'll allow the governor in precedenting setting nature to be able to essentially overturn the results and call a new result or a new election. And what makes it even more shocking is that it was in November that the county judge, our county administrator here, was elected by just 14,000 votes. It was a close race. Harris County, Texas, is the biggest county in the state. It's where Houston is. It's like we have over 6 million people in the region now. And so you can see all this going on here. And this is the county that the Republicans have picked on, the one where the Democrats have now broken through and are starting to win, you know, regularly in that county. It went from being a solidly red county to being ridiculously strongly blue. And now it's the Texas legislature going, whoa, we're not letting that happen anymore. And so now they're going to have this authority. But, you know, I'm assuming this is going to get through the Texas House. It's already flown through the Texas Senate, despite the opposition from the Democrats. And this thing is all queued up and ready to go to give the governor, for the first time ever, the authority to actually overthrow an election. And think about how dangerous that is. Like, as they come back in future election cycles, they can add other stuff onto that.
Sure.
Right? Today, it's just about, okay, you don't have enough paper at a couple polling sites. You know, next time they go, okay, we're just tacking on a little bit extra here. Now, if we think you've done, haven't done enough, open, voter registration, we can go after you. Or if you didn't have enough precincts in our side of town, maybe we can go out. Who knows what it can go from?
But or just because the narrative is we don't believe the outcome. You know, like we've got an entire party in this country. I don't know if you've noticed, but they don't believe that the former guy lost. And that's where a lot of this is springing out of. So I think you're absolutely right when you're saying you're normalizing fiddling with our elections. This is because that's what this is. This is normalizing having one person go, I don't like the result. Weird happened, something that happens, I don't know, occasionally. Now we're going to have an excuse. And like you've said, and I agree with you, it'll be the next thing and the next thing and the next thing.
Well, and the thing is, it's like right now, if you want to get a new election, if you think something's gone wrong, you have to go to a court of law and kind of make your case. And they tried. After the election this last time around, when the judge, county judge, won by a very narrow race, they tried to sue and try to get the election overturned. The judicial system said no. There's not enough here. You haven't proven that the loss, the places that ran out of paper, they've never been able to prove that it meant people didn't vote. Most people just went to other polling sites here in Texas, and particularly in Harris County. If one place has a long line, you can just go to the next one over. You're not stuck at one precinct. So people just went over to the next one, you know, just down the road, you know, and went ahead and voted. We found no evidence that people didn't vote that day because a couple of precincts, you know, ran out of paper.
But here's the thing, Jeremy. Here's my problem with this, because if I'm getting this right, Harris County is a Democratic county. You didn't have enough ballots. So even if you take it to the logical conclusion that people didn't vote, and now you're saying they voted, everyone got their opportunity. Even if you're saying that everyone didn't get to vote, why would they be defending and wanting, you know, opposition votes and using that as the reason and the justification? It seemed to me that you'd be okay with Democrats not voting, considering the resources that aren't already divided equally. It seems curious that this is the direction they're going.
Yeah, and a really big piece to this, you know, there's so many pieces to the whole debate, right? It's like, it had me kind of on the edge of my seat, you know. Like, I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm not often like, whoa, what did they just say? I kind of get closer to the seat, because here's the thing. It's like, so, like I said, in a court of law, you're going to have, you know, to prove what's happening. But the language of this legislation doesn't have much to kind of go on. It's like, it's really kind of loosey-goosey. There just has to be like an assessment, you know, not a legal like evidence brought to the Secretary of State. They can just really bring in just some polling. It can be partisan polling judges in, you know, 14 precincts that say, you know what, I thought we didn't have enough paper. And boom, we have triggered this legislation that now, if Harris County decides an election, and I'm here to tell you, you know, Texas gets closer and closer with every election cycle. It's because of the changing demographics, but it's because of Harris County. Harris County has swung so big, so quickly, that is now threatening statewide elected Republicans. Greg Abbott won Harris County in 2014, but he's lost it badly these last two times. Same thing with Ted Cruz. He's from Harris County, and he won it the first time he ran, but he got smoked there on his reelection. So, and I'm going to predict right now. I hate going into too many predictions, but Ted Cruz is going to lose Harris County just as badly as he did in 2018 to Beto O'Rourke.
I hope it's like worse.
And that is dangerous for the state Republican Party, because now that that has switched over, they don't have enough votes to kind of counter, you know, that kind of a move like they used to. You know, they're losing population in places in the Texas Panhandle and in East Texas that would often, you know, that could have overcome whatever happened in Harris County. But now the numbers are getting so bad in Harris County, like even when there's an underperformance, like it's bad news. You know, think about Joe Biden won Harris County by more than any presidential candidate since LBJ. It's like, and I'm here to tell you, Joe Biden's no LBJ for Texans, you know, and yet he is on the same plane as LBJ, the first Democrat to win by that kind of margin in that county since LBJ. It shocks me.
Nice. I see what you did there. You got that Lloyd Benson, in there. Nice for you. But here's the thing. You know, let's say I defend this because everyone should get the vote and all this. You know, what's the big deal? We're just going to have another election. What's the big deal? Because this has got to be the justification. We're going to have another election, and it's going to be fine. Because why?
Yeah, State Senator Mays Middleton, who's been carrying this bill for the Republican, he's from Gallatin County, which is just south of, you know, of Harris County. He has a few precincts in there. He said, look, there's not going to be another election if you just have enough dang paper. You know, it's like, which is true. You know, it's like he sees the legislation as a way to, like, put such fear that, you know, if you run out of, you know, paper, you're going to have a state or a countywide election again. Now, again, Harris County is huge. This is like asking, like, both Dakotas to rerun their presidential election, potentially, you know, and still much more left over. You know, it's like it's a huge area. So even the cost of it would be put onto Harris County to do the election. So they're going to spend $10, $12, $15 million for a second election, potentially, on something like this. So he says, look, all you got to do is have enough paper there, you know, and he says, if there's a concern that somebody didn't get their vote counted, again, remember, I said that we haven't been able to prove anybody was turned away.
Right.
Despite all of their lawsuits, despite all their testimony within the Texas, you know, legislature, they've never brought someone forward that says, you know, I tried to vote and I couldn't, and I never had another opportunity. It's like never ever had a show that. But Middleton thing, and what we saw happen in November was dangerous enough that we've got to stop it. And it was funny. One of the readers, you know, called me and we were talking about the bill, and he says, you know, it's like, look, you know, you got to understand sometimes like people are incompetent, you know, and this isn't incompetency led to the paper shortage. There was definitely a screw up. But does that justify this? That's the question. And it's like, again, it singles out one county.
Right.
They rejected proposed amendments. Go, like, make sure it applies to everybody. So if, like, so if the neighboring county that's Republican runs out of paper, shouldn't we do the same thing to them? And the answer was no.
Why?
Because it hadn't happened there. At
but
least
it could.
That we know it.
It could. I mean, if you're going to do something to one, you got to do it to everyone. But here's the part of this that I see as interesting. The idea of running another election, because you look at what happens in the midterms. There's a drop off in the number of voters. So for me, it looks like as an outsider. Now, again, I'm not in Texas. It seems as an outsider, the idea is we really don't want people voting. We want to get fewer votes. So we're going to put this obstacle in the way that if we ever get to use our new toy, this might turn an election.
Oh, absolutely. If you think of, like, you know, think about all those, like, you know, I always like to look at Louisiana because they have that, you know, that system where then there's a runoff election after the general election, but the turnout drops dramatically, right? You know, a lot of people are like, I'm not doing this again, you know? And so, and particularly for Democrats, I think that we've seen the numbers, Democrats fall off in special elections on, you know, anything that's not a presidential race, you know, or
which is insane to me.
So the second run is going to get fewer Democrats out and fewer Republicans too. But the evidence that we have from political science suggests that there'll be fewer Democrats who make that second trip out to that polling site for whatever reason. You know, there's, you know, we can go on a whole socioeconomic, you know, discussion on all of that and move on. But so I think that's the thing. You know, it's like you sit there and you try to figure out, like, well, if you do have that second election, the end result might be fewer Democrats to show up. And in this case, if you just have 14,000 fewer of them, you've just won the county judgeship and probably a lot of judicial races and probably some other, you know, countywide races that you never had a shot at.
Yeah, no, they're clearly reading the tea leaves and planning for the next election, which I give Republicans credit for. Look, you go back to 2000, the hanging chads, 2004, you had the caging going on. Then they went to the old voter ID thing and then cross check. There's always a new scheme. There's always something new to suppress votes, to take people's ability to vote away. And I give them credit. They're always dreaming up new ways to screw over voters. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Jeremy Wallace. Jeremy is a political writer for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News, HoustonChronicle.com, the website, if you want to check out the work that he does there. I got to get, before we wrap up, I got to get this House bill, what is it, 2127? It looks like a giant preemption bill. It looks like you local people, again, I remember when Republicans used to believe in small, less intrusive government. They used to believe in local government, to get that fascistic governor out of our way. It used to be, maybe it's been a long time, but they used to believe in local control. This seems to be the antithesis of local control. This seems to be going, sorry, I know you'd like to have a paid sick day ordinance or higher minimum wage or you know, whatever. We want to make sure that the water's clean. Sorry, you can't do that. We'll decide. This seems to be an, like I said, the antithesis of that small local control that they used to tell me they believed in.
Yeah, absolutely. For years, we've been seeing the Republicans in the Texas legislature and really nationwide kind of going after these cities, you know, these big Democratic run cities. You know, think of Miami, think about, you know, Philadelphia, think about New York City. It's like there's always some tension out there. Right. In Texas, that tension's been there, too. But man, this one is so aggressive. It's getting the name the Death Star because how much it encompasses. You know, this is the thing that, you know, takes so much local control. So like even like how you regulate a puppy mill, you know, is no longer going to be, you know, compliant with the law. Now you have to go to the state, you know. Oh, wait, you want to, you know, try to have any sort of regulation in local ordinances. You're going to have to make sure the state doesn't already have something. You know, so it's really taking a lot of power away. And it goes to that tension. It really is a good extension off of what we've seen in Harris County, right? When Harris County was still so Republican and you had Republican county judge running the places and a majority on the county commission there, they would pick on them, but not like this. But now that the biggest city and all of the biggest cities now in Texas have finally gone blue, it was slower than a lot of the other parts of this country. You know, we are Texans, but we ended up, you know, finally, you know, to the point where all of the big major cities now are Democratic, and in the big, you know, metro counties are Democratic. And so that has changed the entire philosophy. Now you've got people getting elected who are like, you know what? We're not going to let you expand your city boundaries without a war. We're not going to let you, you know, have different regulations on your, you know, law enforcement than we have. We're not going to let you, you know, regulate, you know, like I mentioned earlier, anything from puppy mills to, you know, sign ordinances to whatever. Now all of that is ours. You know, it's like, and so I think it's part of the extension of Republicans in the state of Texas fighting the urbanness and the urban change that has happened in Texas. It's really created a war between these two elements that, man, it just wasn't like this before. Yeah, like now it feels like it's constantly, every bill that comes up in the legislature, it feels like a war between the rural communities and the urban communities. And it's sad because, like, look, it's a huge state. You know, I drove from Houston to Spearman, Texas, which is so far north, you're almost in Oklahoma. And some would say you are in Oklahoma. But you know, like, and I thought to myself, these people have no idea how each other lives.
Yep.
And nor do they know how each other has to govern things. They have no clue, like, even one community where 99.9% of the people are Black, another community where 99.9% of the people are white, you know? And so what do you have there? It's like one's rural, one's urban, one has schools that are struggling. One has like this rural school system that's, you know, it's hard to kind of tell if they're struggling or not. But so you have all these differences and it's hard to kind of bring it all together. And what the legislature's kind of doing, again, I don't know if it's intentional, but it's further pitting rural voters against the urban voters. That what's going wrong in Texas is because of you people. And the people in the cities are like, oh my God, we're just trying to get health care. We're trying to legalize marijuana. We're trying to get rid of, you know, throwing people in jail for a small amount of pot. And the rural people are like, nope, we're not doing any of that.
No, it's like, weird. Well, so because I'm glad you brought that up, because it's not just Texas that does this, by the way. You know, it's Philadelphia, it's Pittsburgh, and then they joke about it being Alabama in the middle. But it's always the war between the urbans and the rurals. And I've been fortunate enough to live in both areas. And yeah. When you talk to people about specific issues individually, I think most people get that it's a construct, because most people want the same thing: good schools, safe neighborhoods, you know, decent infrastructure, you know, broadband access, those kind of things. But yet we're always pitted against each other. It's one of those. It's the next level of separating and segregating us, so that we're pitted against each other, so we never get the things that we want. And maybe this is a little bit deeper than you want to go into, but you know, we've been sliced and diced and pitted against each other: white, Black, male, female, gay, straight. However you want to put it, white collar, blue collar, pink collar, ring around the collar. It doesn't matter. As long as we're eating each other, we're continually getting screwed, because we've got a billionaire class that's walking away with all the wealth and we're fighting over crumbs. And for me, you know, going into some of these places over the years that used to be the manufacturing hub of their area that have been left behind, everybody's struggling. But, you know, as long as they keep us in this, you know, in our silos fighting each other, we never get what we need. And that's the frustration in all this for me, Jeremy.
Yeah, well, and man, you just hit it right there. So that's the problem I see right now, where it's like, so like, you know, in rural Mule Shoe, Texas, right? You feel like it's like on another planet than you are in Houston. But I was up there and I'm talking to people, and you realize some of the same issues and things that they're concerned about are the same in Houston. And instead of the politicians going, you know what, we can kind of reach out to both these. Let's find that compromise. It's like, we understand your urban community doesn't have this, but you need the mental health services too, and we do too. Surprisingly, we've realized we need more too. We need community hospitals in a way that maybe the underserved urban areas need them too. Like the food deserts we talk about, you know, like it's the same things happening in both those. There's so much that binds those people together, but it's kind of it's sad to say, it's kind of like bipartisanship. Like that is a like it's more politically useful to pit everybody against each other. And in this case, it's pitting these rural and urban people against each other when they may have more in common than they all understand. But the politicians aren't doing the work to kind of show that.
This is where, you know, I get a little cynical, Jeremy, and I know you've been doing this a long time, as I have. I've gotten a little cynical over our political leaders because it seems more about getting attention and holding on to our seats and getting campaign money than actually doing the hard work of moving us forward. So we get our little silo issue and we fight for this and we're not moving. And then you got it over here. And then we just snipe at each other. And this is the frustration that I have with our political system, because we've got big problems on the horizon. AI is going to eat all of our lunch, and we're not even talking about how we harness this monster. But we're talking about who uses what bathroom. And I don't give a rat's behind who uses what bathroom. I'm worried about putting food on the table and keeping a roof over my kid's head. And for me, this is where we need to get back to. And I think this kind of stuff, this consolidation of power, is dangerous. And I don't care if the Democrats were doing this, I'd be just as against it as I am when the Republicans are doing.
Yeah, I think that this time calls for some politicians who would be brave enough to say, look, I'm going to represent both ends of this thing. You know, damn the election results. I'm just going to go at this. You know, and I'm not sure. And I think there was a point where, like, I don't want to be nostalgic about the good old days type stuff, but it felt like there was a period of time, you know, yeah, again, I don't want to elevate this too much, when Clinton was working with, you know, the Republicans in the House for welfare reform stuff, you know, maybe it didn't work out how everybody wanted it to. Or, you know, even back in the 80s when, like, you know, George H.W. Bush was working with Democrats, and, like, he wanted to keep Planned Parenthood going. You know, and he was getting pressure from the Republicans, but he was pro-life at the same time. So you could see the complication. But there was more negotiation, discussion about those things. Now it's just so hard. Like, No, you're pro-life, you're pro-choice, you're, you know, pro-gun, I'm anti-gun. It's like, and off we go. You know, it's like, and I think it'd be nice to have somebody who could just kind of maybe talk a little bit more about how there's a lot more of us who are similar, even if our, like you brought up, the skin colors are different or the neighborhoods are different. There's so much more we have in common. We just don't know it yet because it's too big of a state for us to know it. But the politicians have seen it all. Like, so, like, in, you know, here's a clarion call that will go unanswered. But, you know, Ted Cruz and John Cornyn have the best perspective on knowing this, right? Because they've been around the state the most. And so they are in the best position to say, look, it's like, we don't have to demonize those people over there. But the question is, what does that mean to them politically if they stop doing that?
No, but here's the thing. I don't blame the politicians. I don't blame politicians at all because they're tools. I blame us, the voters, for allowing ourselves to be hoodwinked into the red hat, blue hat frame. For me, it's not red hat, blue hat versus R or D. For me, it's always been up, down. It's always been the very wealthy who control all of these institutions against the rest of us. And there used to be things that were nonpartisan. They weren't Republican or Democratic issues. They were human people issues, and on both sides demanded results. I'm just not seeing that. I see us, you know, I've done some door knocking, and the first question people ask, you know, what are you? I'm a citizen. No, what are you? And I've got to identify my hat right away before we talk about anything. That's insane to me. And until we change, I fear this kind of stuff is going to continue.
Yeah, one of the ones that drives me the craziest is the use of medical marijuana, particularly for our veterans suffering from PTSD. The fact that we can't come to some sort of agreement in Texas to allow that to happen, while that's other nuts. States that is happening. We literally have, you know, all these studies and research and the examples from the other states that proves this, it could really help some of these guys and, you know, women who come back and are just like, are having a hard time. And instead of giving them this, we are like just leaving them out to dry. And I think it's largely because of politics.
You know, sure. It's insane to me, though. We've got medical heroin.
Yes.
But
yes.
We can't have medical pot. How crazy is that?
That's insane for the veterans, to me. Yeah, when I worked in Florida at one point, I just remember, like, the Republicans started to turn, you know, in support for, you know, medical marijuana, because it turned out all the older folks who had arthritis were like, hey, this is great. This is really helping me. You know, it's just like, why can't we do more of this? Exactly. And then that's got the ball rolling. Like, we just haven't had that happen in Texas at this point, where it's just like, come on, there's just there, there are things we can do that just helps everybody. It's like kind of what you said, when you get down to the base level, how do we just make sure everybody's like going to be healthy enough to go to school and not get shot?
I'm right there with you.
Can we do that? You know, it's like, I think we all want that, right? Nobody wants anybody to be like hurt.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic ABC Media app. News.